Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly, where this week we've been based in the Bavarian capital of Munich, sampling the gargantuan works of Ghanaian-born sculptor Ella Natsui, loaning our ears to a program of public sound works around the city, and hearing about a new technology being tried out by the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra. But we begin at the Haus der Kunst. In March this year, one of the great superstar curators, Akwe Mveza, died at the age of 55 after what seemed like a few lifetimes reshaping the art world into something less centered on what was immediately obvious from New York or London. In recent years, he was head of the Haus der Kunst in Munich, a building created by the Nazis to display art that complied with the ideals of National Socialism. His farewell exhibition there is a blockbuster from the Ghanaian-born artist Ella Natsui, a riot of gargantuan hangings made from bottle caps and other detritus gathered in Nigeria. It's a show that could make you think twice about where the center of gravity in contemporary art lies, which makes it a fitting tribute to Akwe Mveza, according to our guest this time, the show's current guardian curator, Damian Lentini.
When I arrived this morning, the queue was out the door to get in.
Yeah, and that's been a constant for the last 4 months, and it's just a sort of testament to the fact that this isn't a niche exhibition. This isn't, you know, something that someone with a background in African history, West African art, can really appreciate. The amount of time we've seen, not just visitors, but repeat visitors, and many, many people have told me, you know, that they've come six or seven times. You know, people who live in Munich or live in Bavaria, and I think that's just a testament to, you know, the power of the works themselves.
My name is Damian Lentini. I'm a curator here at Haus der Kunst. The last 2.5 years, I was working with Akwe Mveza and Chika Okeke Agulu on Ella Natsui Triumphant Scale. My job now is I'm going to accompany the exhibition to its three other museums. So to Mataf, Modern Museum of Arab Art in Doha, to Kunstmuseum in Bern, and the Guggenheim Bilbao.
So we're now inside one of the huge rooms here, as I think you'll probably be able to hear. The original designers of the building had a certain notion of the way it should look in terms of neoclassical architecture, but then that has a knock-on effect in the way these rooms sound.
Yes, I mean, obviously the one distinct feature of these rooms is not just the volume, but obviously the height of the ceilings. This is architecture that was designed from the very outset to intimidate people. People were just meant to file on through. They were meant to see the art, appreciate the art, but the building was meant to intimidate them. It was meant to make you feel very, very small, and by extension, make the art feel very, very grand.
Ella Natsui was born in what was then the Gold Coast, in Ghana, in a very, very small fishing village. He was one of about 32 children. And he actually grew up in a town not far from where his family lived, part of a sort of a missionary. He then, very much against the wishes of his parents, but he then decided he was going to become an artist. And the idea of someone actually becoming an artist at this time in the sort of 1960s in Ghana was just unthinkable. And he spends a lot of time trying to convince everyone that being an artist is actually a profession, and everyone's sort of saying that you mean sign writer. No, you mean advertiser. No, an artist.
The piece we're standing in front of here, it's impossible not to see it as a kind of comment on the way the rooms are working on people who pass through them.
Yes, I mean, this particular work's gone through a couple of lives. Originally, it was a work called Glee. And the first time Ella Natsui visited Haus der Kunst, he walked into this room, he saw its scale and said, oh, I might have to extend the work a bit. And that's the key word, extend it a bit.
So he studies at university. He studies at an arts academy in Ghana, first and foremost, which still has obviously traces of the colonial legacy. His first teacher, his first professor there was German. He receives a very, very traditional, what we would call a traditional arts education. And then at the beginning of the 1970s, he's applying for jobs, and he gets a job at the University of Nigeria in Nsukka. And so he moves over there. originally short term. He's lived there ever since. And the environment at the University of Nishuka is incredibly vibrant and fertile. It's not long after the end of the Biafran Civil War. There's a huge sort of upswelling of sort of particular Igbo identity. He's sharing a department and sharing a faculty with writers and thinkers and philosophers who are really tackling this idea of sort of local identity, of developing a distinctly West African art, a West African voice. Uche Okeke is probably the most famous. Solinka is there in the literature department. And it's within this sort of environment that he really begins to start developing a lot of the ideas.
What is unique about this work, and we've now actually walked inside it, is it's a huge series of curtains, and they're semi-transparent. It's much lighter than some of the other pieces, but you can move through it. I wonder, can you hear the slight difference in the sound as you do move through it? Because we're now inside a wall, I suppose, is the idea, but one that's also kind of a very rough maze that doesn't present where you should be walking in the room. In fact, encourages you to sort of take some sideways directions and wander a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thinking behind Glee originally was that it was everything a wall wasn't. It looked like a wall, but it was permeable. It was transparent. What it plays with transparency and opacity. You touch it; it's very pliable. You know, it moves, and it allows you to actually look through to other spaces. And so he's always playing with these ideas of architectural elements. He lives in Nishuka in Nigeria, and he was on the search one day for a particular temple or as a particular site just on the outskirts of the city. And then he notices something in the bushes. It catches his eye, and there he finds this bag full of these different colored bottle tops, and he has no idea what to do with them. So this is in 1998, and so he takes them back to his studio, and they sit there in the corner. And for several years, they keep catching his attention, but he has no idea what to do. And then one day he's investigating with all these other sort of metals. He's using oil drums. He's using printing plates. And then one day he decides, you know, he's going to experiment with these sort of very flexible, very malleable sculptures in which he cuts up the bottle tops, flattens them out, and then he creates these sorts of sheets. It's comprised of all of these bottle tops, and each element has been cut out and stitched together with these copper wiring all by hand. This entire thing is created by hand.
And it's a recurring idea when you are looking at the work. You think, oh, this is where people have come together. This isn't the expression of one artist. This is a collective.
The way he works, that many of the people that do work in his studio have been doing so for years, in many cases decades. You know, the studio is very, it's open all hours. People, a lot of them are students. He supports a lot of people there with stipends to study, to you know, give them the opportunity to actually work in creating works like this. So when they've, you know, finished studying at the university, they can go by and spend a couple of hours sitting there. You know, it's meant to be putting things together. It's a very social environment. I mean, a work like this, it took about a year to create the extension, so to speak. Another really important point in relation to all of this as well is he hates the word recycling. He said he's not recycling. He's not, you know, getting his assistants to drink all those bottles of rum and then sort of to make these works. He buys these bottle caps new. And so it is this entire sort of production process. And indeed, his studio itself employs not just a huge amount of assistants and everything else, but actually is for the surrounding sort of city and everything. He does keep a lot of people in business by continually purchasing these different elements. The reason he's used any of these materials is he's always said that he wants to work with material that is readily available to him, that has in many ways gone through multiple stages of use. A lot of businesses are, you know, now selling him these materials because, as you can imagine, to create the hanging sculptures, I mean, you require so much, you know, basic metal material. And so, in some ways, he's almost generated sort of new industries that just, you know, cater to this need.
Now, I have been carefully not touching anything as I went around, but there is a kind of real tactile impetus. But you, as a curator, are you allowed to touch that there?
I mean, obviously, there is always that temptation because they are just so tactile. there is a bit of hesitancy on the part of the public because, of course, they also look very sharp. So there is also this play between, you know, softness and sharpness as well in the work. And he likes playing with these opposing elements, you know, opacity and transparency, you know, the play of light and shadow, as well as this idea that something can be both very heavy and very sharp and very intimidating, yet at the same time also very soft and, you know, lending itself to actually be touched and stroked. The driving force behind this was Ockwin Wesel. Although he wasn't here for the opening of the exhibition, he is absolutely everywhere throughout this exhibition. I actually counted the other day. So during the 4 weeks or so we were installing the show, I sent him 6,734 photos of the exhibition. I sent him 68 videos. We would talk at least three times a day on the phone. I would go through and we would show, you know, videos of the installation. And this was not just me. He would be in communication daily with Elana Tsui himself, with Chico Kekegulu as well. So he was very, very much involved. And one sort of does sense his presence in every single fold and every single nook and cranny. It was very, very important for him, and it's very important for us as well, that we were doing this exhibition not because Elana Tsui is an artist from Africa. Okwi's idea was always that Elana Tsui was, and it still is, one of the most important living sculptors, irrespective of where he comes from. If the idea that he is an African artist is an entry point into the work, then so be it. When we're talking about global contemporary art, we're not talking about, you know, introducing the rest. It's actually about expanding the remit of contemporary art and the contemporary art museum. And that's what we're trying to also posit with Elana Tsui. It's not like he suddenly turned up from left field and has never been known. He's been part of this conversation about the place of the global within contemporary art. And so with a sort of survey show here, it's not, we don't want to sort of say, look, he's arrived. We want to actually say he's already been here.
House der Kunst curator Damian Lentini there, and Elana Tsui Triumphant Scale runs in Munich until the end of the month before moving to Doha in October, Bern in March, and the Guggenheim Bilbao in July next year. On a hillside to the south of the great parklands created for the 1972 Olympics, next to the tent-like stadia, which still look like buildings from a distant planet nearly 50 years later, Bavarian artist Franziska Agrival has chosen this location for her contribution to a citywide sound art project running in Munich this summer called Frequencies. For Frequencies, artists have created sound work in abandoned shops, built audio-augmented reality sculptures, and performs street opera in the heart of the city. But Agrival, an artist whose practice regularly crosses from industrial design to ice sculptures and indeed yoga projects, took to the grassy hills for her work. Nature Unplugged features a series of semi-pyramidal shapes scattered in the hills around the Olympic Park, where she invites visitors to sit down and tune in to the environmental sound all around, an invitation she extended to Culturefile.
So we're right up at the top of a set of hills, not really very far from the centre of Munich.
Olympia Park is actually located quite central in the city. There's a northern part of the park which has been built for the 72 Olympics here in Munich. And then there's a southern part which got created after the Second World War by all the destroyed houses and the destroyed material of all housing in the city. People moved everything on that one place. That's how the hills got built.
They're very big hills.
Yeah, actually that's why it's also called Olympia Alm here. And Alm is a part of a hill or like a big grass field in the Alps. The landscape here is a bit made like so it looked like we would be in the Alps, and so we are that far high up so we can see the mountains from here. My name is Franziska Agrawal, and I am the artist who did the project Nature Unplugged for Frequencies in Munich, which is a sound-based project run by the City of Munich, the Cultural Department.
So we're on top of another hill. We've been up one hill along a plain and then up another hill, and we can actually look back and see a lot of the city behind us. It's pretty peaceful.
We're just now approaching the installation and walking up the hill, and it's placed actually on one of the highest places of the hill. It's surrounded by many trees and bushes. It's a purely geometric construction, and the design of the structure is made out of triangles, and it's a structure which basically catches sound.
It is, I suppose, it's a geometrical version of an ear.
Exactly. You could say that it's a big ear in which you can sit or lie or sit in front. It enhances the surrounding sound and noises.
Well, let's check that out. You can sit on it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you can lie down and you can also just look up into the trees. Half of the body is on the grass and the other half is inside the ear.
I was very interested in your practice in general because, as we were saying, you have a big foot in design and you also have your art practice. You also have the work with snow and ice, which is part of your art practice, but in a pretty kind of ephemeral way. Tell us how you got involved in that.
My work with snow and ice has been following me throughout my whole career. And for me, it's a very interesting material because it's so short-lived and it's very natural and also very clean. I like the way I can actually work in a very large scale. In that sense, my studio has to be outside. The whole work process to realize a piece has to be in a specific location with very specific outlines. It has to be very cold. I need a good snow. And then the work with the material itself, I basically make it, but I don't create it so it can be there to be sold. So the whole process of making is actually the only time when it's existing. And then there is only one moment of perfection when it's there. And this moment cannot be predicted of how long this will be.
The other part of your practice that we haven't talked about is your yoga practice. Here we are lying in the middle of the forest listening to the birds. It's not completely unrelated to a meditation practice, is it?
No, it's not. And you're totally right. It is actually combining maybe all three areas of my personal and my work-related interest. And meditation and yoga is definitely closely connected to the project. We didn't do a vernissage here, so there was no opening for the installation. But what I did was a yoga session, which was called Yoga Unplugged. That was very nice because I said that we will not have any props, meaning that there's no mat, nothing. You'll just do it on the grass and you'll be directly connected to the nature. And it's also something what has to be practiced to be able to disconnect. So this installation is some kind of tool.
How much of that did you explain when you were pitching the project?
About the yoga, I didn't say anything. Like now, I didn't say anything.
I mean, for me, that's a fascinating aspect of the project, but there is kind of an art world thing where you'd feel maybe that people would be resistant to that in some way.
Yeah, I think this is also something what I'm confronted with all the time because the average person is not really informed about what yoga really is. So there is a lot of prejudice about it. And also it is, I think, by many seen as a very esoteric thing to do and also a thing to believe. And for me, yoga is that in, it's a science of life and the human body and the mind.
Franziska Agrival there, taking a pew in her Nature Unplugged project in Munich. And projects in the Frequency programme will run in the city through all the warm months. And finally, on this week's Culturefile Weekly, how to build an invisible concert hall in the middle of a city. Classics at the Odeonplatz is a long-standing tradition in Munich, with each July orchestras such as the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra and their guests performing in the out-of-doors at the Odeonplatz. But the main trouble with outdoor concerts, other than the very real prospect of rain, is that the sound of the orchestra is never as rich and nuanced as when they're in a perfect concert hall. This year, Classics at the Odeonplatz trialled a new technology to cure that, a system which digitally gives the orchestra walls and a ceiling off which their sound can reverberate. Culturefile went to meet the engineer running the computers that make this happen, Johnny Pipping, as he prepared for last weekend's concert with René Fleming and the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra.
We are at the Odeonsplatz in Munich. It's a great big place. We have this hall called Feldherrnhalle, which is an open structure. And inside there's a symphony orchestra that will play for about 8,000 people. I'm Johannes Pippig, called Johnny, from Norman Müller. I'm an audio technician, taking care here on the Odeonsplatz for the network connections and the system components to talk to each other in the right direction.
All around us, the square is bristling with lights, but also an array of speakers, an array of monitors that we're not used to seeing at a concert.
Yeah, there's speakers on each side that direct to the audience. The idea is to rebuild in a digital way the reflections from a wall that's not existing there. Because normally when you listen to a classic orchestra in a concert hall, you have the orchestra, and you have a building, a room. You have walls, you have a roof, a ceiling. And this is something we don't have here. And the other problem is we have, as I said, 8,000 people. Of course, they can't hear the orchestra live. We have to amplify it. The challenge is to get this amplified, of course, and to get the audio, the feeling as good as it not amplified.
What is the problem we're solving here? Open-air concerts do happen. People go to them. They're relatively satisfied sometimes with being in the out-of-doors in the summertime, and that's enough of a compensation maybe for not hearing concert hall music.
Yeah, but we can do it better. We can be outside and enjoy the, well, at the moment not good weather, but normally the good weather, and have a concert as we are, have an orchestra that doesn't sound too amplified through speakers and as you're used to it when you are at home and switch on your stereo speakers. Normally it sounds amplified, and we try to make this happen that it's not sounding that amplified.
So how are you doing that?
That we're using the DMB Soundscape, which is a system that we have an array of speakers at the front of the stage and up at the and over the stage. With all the speakers, we make object-based mixing. So if you sit in the first few rows, the violin comes from where it's really sitting, not from the speaker on the right or the left. It's just coming from that position. So if you close your eyes, the orchestra is in front of you.
So tell us about that noise we're hearing.
Just a white noise to check. The one thing is if they are basically running. But this will happen the next few minutes, just to make sure that every speaker and every feed is working and that the time alignment is correct.
So how many of these speakers do you have around? You're going to have to check every one of them.
We have 16 each side that make this around there Y10, so very wide, to make a lot of room. Normally, when you have a stereo system, you make the positioning, putting more, if the guitar player is on the right, you pan it more to the right. So at the right speaker, there's more guitar, and the left speaker is less guitar. And your mind thinks that it's coming from the right side because it's louder there. And that's the one thing you can do. And the other thing is you make it with time alignment. The signal comes from the right side a little bit earlier than from the left side. And with this, you can also make your mind think the guitar comes from the right side. And in this case, we work with both systems, of course, much more complex. We have 64 separate position points on stage, which are single musicians or some small groups. And they all are on the right position where they are. And the big computer from DMB makes it happen that the routing and the time alignment is made automatically. In this case, it's classic. In this case, you go back again. It's normally not amplified. So in this case, you try to make it sound like it was that it's not amplified. And if it's a jazz singer or a rock singer, it's okay because they have a microphone in front of them. You know this, and you can use a compressor, you can use effects, you can do whatever you want, and it's okay.
One of the things that that always strikes me about great sound is you wonder how much the audience is demanding it. You know, that technologies appear and people go, I know what I could do with that. But do the audiences care so much?
I think yes. It makes a difference between a good sound and somebody say, wow, that was fantastic. And that's the bit that's our challenge to achieve.
Voice of René Fleming there, and you heard also from concert engineer Johnny Pippin. And that brings to a close our short visit to Munich. We'll be back each day next week with new files from, among other destinations, the Galway Arts Festival. Until then, bye now.